Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Lauren Baer, author of Medusa's Sisters, published by Ace, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. It'll be released in just a couple of days on August 8th. Her next book will be Mother of Rome, the story of Rea Silvia, mother of Romulus and Remus, supposed wife of Mars, Aries, depending on which era you're talking about. And as you guys know, Romulus and Remus are the founders of Rome. And as in this book, perhaps the woman is given short shrift. And Lauren is also a teaching fellow for the Holocaust Center for Humanity. So Medusa has a bad rap, honestly. I mean, any man who looks upon her turns to stone. She's a Gorgon, a monster. But reimagined by Lauren, Medusa and her sisters, the stoic and practical Steno, and the sarcastic, envious, flighty's not the right word, but kind of flighty, Euryale, are beautiful young maidens striking out on their own and seeing the world after a strange birth and upbringing, seeing the world, having adventures, and then tragedy befalls all three, and their lives are altered irrevocably and primarily for the worst. But some good and growth comes of their transformation, and we learn a lot about overcoming adversity and growing, notwithstanding immense challenges and dealing with siblings that are loved, envied, and complex. The gods are, as usual, omnipresent and omniscient and play an enormous part in the story. And their full panoply is enumerated in the cast of characters that Lauren presents at the very beginning of the book, just before the prologue. So Poseidon and Athena kind of are center stage, with Zeus, Ceto, the Grey, Leto, and many more fleshed out, if you will, throughout. And in some ways, Perseus, the most important of all. But I'm going to try to avoid spoilers. So, Sisters 3, a view of the Medusa myth that hasn't been seen before, and bends the portrait of the mortal, which was previously portrayed by Jane Ellen Harrison in her seminal study of Greek religion, and the epigraph of this book, although Lauren gets a little dig in her at the end in the acknowledgments.
You noticed that, did you?
Welcome, Lauren. Thanks for coming by today.
I'm so thrilled to be here. And also, that was a really excellent summary of Medusa's Sisters. When it's time for me to write one for Mother of Rome, I'm going to be calling you up. That was fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. So, Lauren, because I'm a bookseller, and when people come into the store, that's what they look at, the cover of the book. I wondered if you had one you could show us.
I actually do. It's my fourth baby. So here's the cover of the book, Medusa's Sisters. And there's just so many little touches that I love. I love the binding. And then there's this really great snake image. I mean, I'm just so proud. Here it is. Look how pretty.
Oh, it's beautiful. And it really does accent the story. And we can talk about the different snakes that each of them have, which was really cool.
That was actually one of the first decisions I made when I tackled writing the book, is that they had to look different than the iconic image of Medusa, which we all know, right? It's the screaming woman with all the green snakes. We all know that image. And to create the characters of Steno and Euryale, I had to give them a different look. And once they physically looked different in my mind, their personalities almost grew from there.
It's interesting because you mentioned all three of them. What was the beginning, the prologue, before all the episodes? And there's many of them, but they're divided up really nicely. But in the prologue, Steno is talking about why the first thing she says is she hates the number three. And I thought about it, and three, first being prime, but then there's so many trinities, like the Trinity. So why did you start with that?
I think that for Steno, she creates a life for herself being the oldest sister. And when I first started researching the Medusa story, one of the first things you find out is that two of the sisters were immortal. Medusa was mortal, which I could not figure out a reason why that was physically, biologically possible. I had to create kind of a mythology for that myself just to make sense of it. But then you have to imagine yourself as these three sisters, really triplets, born together, and knowing always that one of you is going to die and the other two aren't. And I think that is the pivotal part of her personality, Steno, the older sister, is this fear, this constant anxiety that one of her sisters is going to die, that Medusa will die. You know, and it sets their path.
I kind of jump around all the time, but when you said that about the mortal, talk a little bit, no one knows this, about the call and how you can tell as the baby head comes out whether it's going to be mortal or immortal.
I had to figure out a way. It just doesn't make sense. And that's part of the fun of reading Greek myths, the suspending reality, right? It can be very escapist. But when you're trying to write a modern book for a modern reader, you need to have some kind of system that makes sense. And I couldn't figure out why like two immortals could have a mortal child, or a mortal and an immortal could have, you know, I was doing, who was the monk with like the grids with the peas, you know what I mean? The geneticist.
Greg Mendel.
Yes. I was like trying to make this for the mortals and immortals, and it doesn't add up. So I created this idea of the call. And if you were born in one, that meant you would be an immortal. And Medusa is not born in one. You know, she's born, stillborn in my story, strangled around her neck, which bursts the call or ruptures it. So that was kind of how I created a way that she could be a mortal amongst immortal beasts. And then I used that later on in the story too, but I don't want to talk about spoilers.
I know, it's funny because, you know, you think of a Greek myth and you think, okay, wherever you found the Greek myth, Bullfinch or who's the current guy, you know, the popular one who, for kids mostly.
Oh, Percy Jackson.
Yeah. So yeah, you think, okay, I know the Greek myths, but because you reimagined them, there's lots of license you took. But you say, you acknowledge exactly what license you took, which is perfectly fine. But so that reminds me of the origin story of Medusa and her sisters, and what a nasty one it was.
It is. And it's funny because so many people think of Medusa, I think, as either a sex symbol. You know, there's like Britney Spears at the VMAs with the snakes, you know, like it's translated over time, or as a symbol of rage. And I wanted to create a Medusa that wasn't either of those things. I took rage, I gave it to one sister. I took sex and gave it to the other sister. But Medusa herself, I couldn't find no evidence of Medusa killing anybody ever when I was in the primary source material. So for her to have this reputation is conjecture, really. I think it's crazy and pretty wild that the people she does murder is when she's disembodied and when her head is used as a catalyst by Perseus or by others to kill people. And she has literally no agency over that. So yeah, my Medusa is very different. My Medusa in ways is more like she has like Disney princess qualities about her.
Yeah. And Steno doesn't, but she has all these excellent qualities. And if you're talking about death, by turning into stone, she's the one who first, I'll say without spoiling, Thales, you know, he's in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he's the first one, and she nails him, and then she nails a bunch of other people. Yeah. But, you know, again, as a bookseller, after the cover, people look at the epigraph. And we spoke a little bit before we began the program about the woman whose epigraph you use, Jane Ellen Harrison. And in the epigraph, it essentially says that the other two don't really care. They're not part of the whole story. And that's where you took off, right? So how come you use that as an epigraph?
I had to. And the fact that I found, I mean, I did so much real research, but that's the Wikipedia quote. So there was kind of this tongue-in-cheek moment for me to put it at the beginning of the book. Like, I got this from Wikipedia, you guys. I mean, I did go and find her actual text and I read through that chapter on Medusa. But I think that not just for Medusa's sisters, but for all of women in antiquity, whether it's real history or the oral tradition, the storyteller's tradition, the women there face a particular plight. And it's that, you know, their lives were very much dictated by the men around them. And then on top of that, the record of that life was dictated by the men around them. And they tend to disappear. They tend to not exist. And so, yeah, we have such, for a modern reader, like almost embarrassingly inauthentic stereotypes of what women were like in the Greek myths. So I am not surprised at all, especially in a time where we care about counter narrative and perspective, that people are going back and revisiting these stories and recentering what happened on the characters that didn't have any voice or agency.
With regard to epigraphs, each of the episodes has an interior epigraph, and they're penned for the most part, almost all the part, by Erastus of Athens. So when I look up Erastus of Athens, your book comes up. So I go, wait a minute, who is Erastus of Athens?
Well, and that's one of those things where, I mean, I made him up. I wrote all those quotes and the ones that are anonymous, which actually is a book club question I wrote. Who do you think is anonymous? Who wrote those ones? But that's one of those funny things where some of my friends in my book club have read the book and they've asked about the quotes and they just assumed those were real. It was like, oh no, I made that up. Or the call thing, like, no, I made that up. Like, this is not canon, people. I made a lot of things up. Or again, spoiler, Athena's shield, right? And what happens with Athena's shield, I made that up as well. That's not, you know, a part of the real myth.
It might be kind of true. I think I read somewhere. You know, it's really funny because Medusa is part of the flag of Sicily. It actually is the flag of Sicily. There's a bunch
That's
of things.
Wild. Well, and I mean, I think of her. I think Gianni Versace had her face at the bottom of his pool.
Right. Yeah.
In Miami. Yeah.
It's actually the symbol for Gianni Versace. The other one that's really weird is she was on the belt buckle of the French soldiers in World War I, as if her image could turn them to stone.
That's so cool. But again, it's her head. It's her disembodied version of herself. You know, she had no control over how people used her body, how people used her image and her story. Although I will say, this is not a Medusa story. It's a Medusa story, but it's not her version of the story, right? It is right. Her version as interpreted by her sisters. She doesn't get a voice in my book. Her sisters do.
Well, like in many novels, although this is really well done, each chapter, and you go from first person, you know, it's really interesting how you switch the persons, but each chapter is about one of the sisters. So it goes back and forth and back and forth, and you learn their viewpoint and how they feel, which reminded me, since we're talking about Erastus, of, you know, Steno has Medusa and
which one?
Her Steno's sister and Medusa's sister.
Uriale,
I should have known. Yes, Uriale. So they both kind of know who they are to a certain extent, but Steno doesn't until she goes to Erastus' house. And so how does music play such an important part in her story and why?
That was such a testament to the oral tradition and the basis of human folklore. I love how these stories came down through the ages, through music, in a way when literacy was not an option for people. I think it shows this like indomitable human spirit, this indomitable human urge to tell story. And so to do it through music, when that's the option available to you, I think is really, really beautiful. And so that segment, their sojourn in Athens, they meet Lygia and Erastus, who are a couple. Erastus is a famous musician. And as they stay with this couple, they learn there's more to the musical dynamic between this husband and wife than it appears on the surface. And that also reflects into some of the themes of the story overall, right? And how women are able to make their mark or tell what happened to them when their methods and their world is so limiting.
You know, so as we drill in further, I'm thinking some of our readers, your readers will know this, but why don't we move outward for a bit and start with Cronos and eating his kids and how that worked out as far as this story comes about.
When you study when you look at the oldest stories, basically, you just see the same themes, the same plot lines happen over and over again, right? And especially in Greek myths, there is this father's fear of the next son, right? And it's fun when you go back and you see it just happen over and over again. You know, Cronos eating all his children, Zeus escaping and coming back to save them all. And then you see Zeus do the same things. So, you know, it's not like he's some savior. And then the humans model the gods' behavior or vice versa, depending on who's the real creator here. But that's what happens with Perseus, right? Is that his grandfather hears a prophecy that his grandson will come back and kill him. And that leads to Perseus, you know, his mother being imprisoned and sent away. So there's always this fear of losing power. And maybe that's why women weren't giving a voice. It's these, you know, very sensitive kings and gods who can't handle anyone challenging their rule.
Yeah, you talk about whether the humans kind of created the gods created the human, who did what. But it's interesting because, you know, Apollo and Zeus both play an important part, and their libidos also play an important part. But is it like because they're looking at the humans as playthings? Can we excuse them from their actions, or are they just evil creatures? Because it's a difficult question.
It's such a difficult question. I think that I think that when I wrote, especially Poseidon, I had to create for him, I had to think of him as a man, character, god, person, I don't even know what to call him, right? Who is not raised with the same standards of humanity or life as I have been or the rest of us have been, right? So I'm not excusing his actions, but he's not going to behave in a way that fits our own moral code.
Yeah, and it's funny. I'm just, when I look down, I'm taking notes or looking up something. It's like, I couldn't help but think of Aquaman when I was thinking of Poseidon, the movie.
Yeah.
Jason Momoa, because he, especially when you say his black hair, which is so black, it's almost blue.
And yes.
You painted a very good picture of each of these characters, because not just the sisters because of what they looked like, but, and their beauty at first, but you painted a really good picture of what everyone kind of looked like.
You just reminded me of something and now I can't think of what I was gonna say.
About Poseidon, about hair.
Oh no, it was about the toxic power relationships with the gods and the humans. You know, it's never going to be an equitable relationship when one has unlimited power and the other doesn't, right? It's just set up. It's too uneven. It's too unbalanced. It's never going to be fair. What I wanted to show in this story is that it's not just the male gods that abuse power, that it's the female gods as well, because they're raised the exact same way as their brothers and fathers and husbands. So I was examining what they would be like as well.
The other interesting thing about that statement is Athena, you know, I said at the beginning, Perseus was maybe the most important character, but actually, again, without spoilers, Athena really drives the entire pivotal. Totally pivotal.
She is. And I mean, her interference in the story is what, you know, creates the Gorgon, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a book club question that's up for debate, is who is more responsible for the Gorgons? Is it Poseidon? Is it Athena? Again, without giving too much away. I'm curious what people will think and how they would answer that question.
Yes, when this book is in our book club, and you mentioned book clubs, there's going to be all kinds of arguments because people are steeped in what they've learned about Greek mythology. And they're going to say, yeah, you know, he did the right thing. She kind of did the right thing because she deserved it. But the interesting thing you did that I've never seen done is Euryale stands up to Poseidon. And in one pivotal moment, so does Steno.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of kick butt in a way.
Thank you. It takes them a while to get there.
Yeah. But that was really, you know, she kind of pokes him in the chest. And I'm thinking, no, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. You're thinking Jason Momoa. You're like, no one pokes him in the chest.
Right, exactly. Me, a 71-year-old man, poking this gigantic guy in the chest and expecting not to be punished by it.
You know, also, you brought up something earlier, and I wanted to go back to that for a second, if you don't mind, about the alternating narration that I chose. Because that was actually when I was working with my editor, who's so brilliant. Listen to your editors, people. They know what they're talking about. But one of my non-negotiables with her was that I wasn't going to change the narration, because she mentioned, you know, it might be easier if you just do two first person voices or two third person voices. And he was like, absolutely not. These characters, to me, they came in these voices very organically, because to me it matched who they are as women. You know, Steno is much more open, and I felt like she, as a leader, would take a first person voice. And Euryale, you know, she's prickly. She's not going to let people in as easily. And I think that access is a privilege, right? Whenever you give your reader a first person, or your character a first person voice, you're giving access. And I couldn't imagine Euryale giving that up so easily.
Yeah, at first, I honestly thought, hey, is this going to work the way she's doing this? And then it's not so much that it fit into me, I fit into it.
Oh, I love that.
And it became very natural for me to read in this fashion. And also, sometimes when you're talking in different voices and the chapters are for different people, you like one better than the other. So you don't really want the next one to be her. And this time, it was really good because it gave you so much, not background, but the current of the book. The current of the book was driven along by three separate narratives, I think.
I love hearing that, because I've done the same thing where I'm like, oh, it's so-and-so's chapter again. And I did see, I've actually stopped because my friend Genevieve Gornicek, who wrote, you know, Witch's Heart, and
I interviewed her before
Did you really? She's so wonderful. I love her. But she told me, she was like, Lauren, this is your debut. You got to stop looking on Goodreads. You know, Goodreads is for readers, not for writers. So I have stopped. And I think I stopped because the last one I had read said, I hated one of the sisters so much that I skipped every single one of her chapters. I was like, oh no, like you're missing all of the story then. And I know that some people are going to struggle with Urily. I get that. But I would hope that even if you don't like her, she's still believable, you know, or you can still understand her.
Yeah, it's like Peaky Blinders, you know, he does horrible things, yet you still have this admiration and like for him. And you do with Urily as well. And so, no spoilers.
Yeah, I know.
It's funny with Genevieve, like I said, it was before she got popular. So Madeline Miller is kind of a friend of mine because she only lives like half an hour away. So I texted her and said, hey, you should read this. And she goes, oh, I'm so excited. I look forward to it.
That's amazing. Also, yeah. I feel like all of us who write retellings, it's like Madeline Miller's name gets thrown out so much. This poor writer, like we all owe her a dollar every time someone throws her name out. I feel bad.
I called her when she was a question on Jeopardy and she goes, wow, I can't believe it. And then now, and she's so nice that I think maybe I shouldn't do this, but I texted her and I took a picture of the book, which has stayed in the same place in my bookstore for 5 years now. And I told her I should start charging her rent. I can't get it out of the way, both of them and Galatea. But what she says is, oh, I'm so sorry. And I said, you know, I'm kidding, you know.
Yeah, you're too nice.
Yeah,
I mean, to be a Jeopardy question is like the ultimate. It's the ultimate. You've made it if you're a Jeopardy question.
Well, so back to you and selling your book rather than Madeline's, which doesn't need the help. So the story about, there are lots of stories in the book that don't necessarily surround or involve the sisters, like you were talking about with Perseus and her mother. And that was really interesting too. Or the music that we discussed. And what made you decide to go into such a amount of detail on the island and Danae and her son and the entire plot of that story?
Well, I think it would be boring to just create Perseus as this like aggro hero, you know, like macho hero guy. And so I think when I write, I've thought about this a lot recently, like what am I trying to do with my writing? Obviously to entertain, right? But I think that what I personally care about the most is creating opportunities for compassion. I think that's really it for me. And when I was writing Perseus, I just saw so much sadness in that story. And so even though he is the murderer of Medusa and what he did is not heroic in any way, I had a lot of empathy for him as well.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't just simplify him and just make him this, you know, this bro, this dude who comes in with his sword and does his thing.
Awkward, and he realizes he's been double crossed, which I may, yeah. And but he's a good person. He has the best of motives.
And this is true. When I was researching again in all of these old Greek and Roman texts, another question that came to me as I was writing the book is, what happened to the head? And I think I had already written the first draft where I realized I don't know where the head ends up. And from what I can find, and I don't remember the source, it's in all my notes, he buried it. Perseus buried the head because he didn't want it used anymore as a weapon. And again, hearing that kind of helped support who I made him into. Like, I think, and also he seems to have like a happy marriage with one woman, you know, like there are a lot of things about Perseus's story that aren't typical to the male characters in Greek mythology. So yeah, I did have empathy for him, and I wanted him to be a little different.
Yeah, you did the same thing with Hephaestus.
Yeah, I like him.
I liked him too.
And it's funny, when I was a child, my favorite god or goddess by far was Athena. And then here I am as an adult. It's like, isn't that part of growing up, is like you kill your heroes or something? I don't know.
Well, that goes to what we were talking about before, is the two ways of looking at things, whether the gods created the humans or the humans created God. And in Steno's inspired speech, she's kind of implicating that, almost like when in Lord of the Rings, when they sail into the West, you know, it's almost like, yeah, your time will come.
Yes.
And that scares them.
Definitely. And like, if you are fueled by worship, what happens when there's no more worship?
Yeah.
Who are you? Oh, I was thinking about, like, I included the Semele story, which some people might know that myth. You know, she was one of Zeus's many lovers, a princess of Thebes. And again, there's no evidence that the Gorgons met Semele or even that they went to Thebes. But there's so little about them. I really needed to expand their story because I always knew it was going to be a novel, right? But I needed to put in some more adventures for them. So I looked at like the chronology of the Greek myths, and Perseus is actually one of the earliest Greek myths. He is an ancestor of Heracles or Hercules. So way, way before we get the Hercules stories, way before the Trojan War, this is very early in the mythological canon. So I didn't have a ton of kind of, the stories most people think of are somehow related to the Trojan War, like Odysseus. These are earlier stories. And the Athens they go to would have been an Athens without a Parthenon. You know, it would have had the original temple to Athena up there. This is before Pericles, before, you know, Athens really took off and became this like pillar of democracy. We're not there yet. So that was important to think about in this story.
Yeah, and as much as the book empowers women, you still have women falling for the wrong guys. This is like a classic story, you know. They really,
you know, and it's real life, because I have some like really amazing girlfriends, like so smart, so strong, so cool, and they still sometimes fall for these losers. You know, it's just it's. I don't know. Is it human nature, human habit? But
no,
it's relatable.
I think it's just men and women.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. I have ways of explaining it, but I'm not going to do it on this show.
I'll add this too. I really wanted there to be examples of wonderful men in here too. You know, I think that Erastus is a wonderful man. I think he is a extremely supportive husband who really doesn't just love his wife, but he believes in her, right? And so I wanted him in there. And their nephew is a great guy. There are some good dudes in this story as well.
Yeah, and go back to the epigraphs, which are kind of evanescent, because you have to think about how is this tied to the chapter. I'm not sure how it's tied. And then you kind of realize, but it's funny because, yeah, Erastus, he doesn't take the credit for what he does. He gives the credit to the right person. But why is he such, if you will, a poet with regard to the epigraphs? And what was the impulse in your mind that said, I'm picking out this one person who I think is really good to give essentially a frontispiece to each of the chapters?
Well, here is my book club question, would be, and I'm not going to answer it, but I think people should debate it, is did Erastus write those or did Lygia?
Oh, just like everything else in their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I never thought of that.
So I'm not answering the question, but it's something to think about.
Well, once you let the book out, it's up to the reader and you can't do anything about it.
It is. And you know what's funny is that originally when I had crafted Medusa's Sisters, I had these, like, I think Anne Carson does the most amazing translations of ancient Greek material. Like, they're so brilliant and they're so modern and cool. And I had different Anne Carson quotes that I had found for all the chapters, but like quickly realized that I couldn't afford, it would just be this like huge process to get permission from Anne Carson to have, you know, lines of her poetry at the beginning of every chapter, that it's not as simple as it sounds. So I was having some wine with some of my girlfriends. One of my friends just looks at me, she's like, well, you're a writer, write your own poems. So that is literally why I wrote those, because my girlfriend was like, get to it.
It's funny because in the beginning, and me going down the rabbit hole as well, like you did, you know, these women had all these sisters and the gray, how do you pronounce, is it gray?
I think so. Gray eye. Yeah. I know. We talked about this earlier before the podcast began, but never make fun of someone for mispronouncing a word. It means they learned it from reading.
Yeah.
Or the gray sisters, the gray women.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me. And the thing is, what kind of life? You have one tooth and one eye, and then you get screwed even with that by a protagonist.
Right. And you could imagine the complicated rivalries and emotions between here, one trio of children that are quite lovely, born of the same parents, and then this trio of very awkward, you know, terrifying women. Of course they're going to have rivalries between their trios.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing, researching further, I had no idea that of all these sisters, Scylla was one of the daughters too. And then I looked up Charybdis, and Charybdis is another kid of Apollo. And then—
Oh, wild.
Yeah. And then we were going to go to Sicily. And then I thought of you always imagine, you know, like in the never ending story, these two statues kind of on either side, barring your way.
I love that. Yes, you're right. Well, and it's also hard because the source material does not always agree when it comes to Greek god, goddess, monster genealogy. And that was also really frustrating for me when I was putting this book together, is all the conflicting opinions. And it's easy to get in your head about it. And at one point you just have to let it go, pick one and move on. And so with their parents, you know, the sea beasts, I found a lot of varying stories about
who
their children were, where they came from, and you just do your best.
Oh, even weirder, I was wrong. Charybdis is not the daughter of Poseidon. She's the daughter of Poseidon.
Yes, yes. And Echidna, who is kind of like a major sea beast, is one of their sisters. And she features in the story because she has a relationship with Medusa.
Yeah, I know. And then, you know, it's interesting how Poseidon's wife kind of stayed out of things. I was wondering why. She had a motive, but she just kind of like let it be. Like, she knew this guy was doing what he does.
And she hid from him too. You know, she tried to escape him and he tracked her down. So yeah, I also think like the vengeful wife, I already checked that box because Hera shows up in the story. So we didn't need another one.
Oh, tell the story about Athens and the fight, not the fight, but the contest between Poseidon and Athena.
That one's so great. So in the earliest days of Athens, they're seeking patronage from a god, and it was like a hot commodity city. A lot of the gods and goddesses wanted it. And the two that stood out were Athena and Poseidon. And it's one of those situations where they ask Zeus to arbitrate and he refuses to do it because he's such a coward, really, when it comes down to it. And he's not going to choose between his brother and his sister, or his daughter, excuse me. So what does he do? He makes the mortal man do it. It's so like, you know, the Trojan War and the apples, and Zeus just being like, I don't know, why doesn't, you know, this human dude do it? So or one of these early kings of Athens is like, well, what can you give us? And Poseidon does this great show of cracking open the earth, and the ocean water shoots out at the top of the Acropolis, which is cool, right? But then Athena raises an olive tree instead. And it's so obvious that this is a smarter choice. Like, they don't need an influx of seawater, but like having an olive tree is a great bounty for the city. So they pick Athena, and their rivalry really kicks off there. It features quite heavily in my story. And then I've seen it echo in other myths that happen farther down the line. Like, don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure when the Trojan War happens, they pick separate sides or separate heroes.
I think when you said in one of the interviews that, I guess, who you'd want to meet, you talked about Helen and Paris.
I did. I sure did. And I'm a happily married woman, but I was like, give me one night with Paris. I just want to know, like, was it worth it, girl?
Yeah, really screwed up a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, and Menelaus, and wait a minute, who was Paris's brother? Who?
Hector.
Hector got killed by Achilles. Yeah, Hector was a cool guy, and Paris was a coward. Well, yeah, you should rather be with Hector than Paris.
I agree. And actually, I love Hector. He's probably one of my favorite Greek Trojan characters. And with Mother of Rome, so that's the new novel I'm working on. It's due very soon, so I'm frantically trying to finish it. It's slated for publication in 2024. But you mentioned I'm doing, you know, Rea Silvia and early Rome. So Rome before it becomes Rome. And really, these people are the descendants of Aeneas from Troy, and his flight from Troy when the city is burning with his father and his son, and his journey to find a new home. And he was very much a refugee, going from place to place with the people, with the other survivors of Troy, trying to find some place to settle. And he eventually ends up in Italy and marries Lavinia, who was a princess of one of the Latin tribes. And so it's Aeneas of Troy and Lavinia of Italy, of the Latins, who create these people that will become the Romans. So I've been thinking a lot about the Aeneid and Aeneas, and he was a cousin of Hector.
Oh, so, I didn't know.
Yeah, he was part of that royal family. So yeah, I'm kind of tracing that now into Rome.
Oh, that's fascinating. It's funny because, you know, Genevieve, Madeline, and, you know, everyone tries to copy Madeline's covers. At the bookstore, I look at it and I go, wait a minute, this isn't her. But it's interesting how, I know things come and go, but it's interesting how all these books tell the story from the viewpoint of a woman who either was ostracized or thought of in a way that, it's just like that one book that makes Grendel kind of a sympathetic character.
That is one of my favorite, like, formative retellings is Grendel, because yes, it's told by the monster, but it's also told in such like a smart literary way. Who's the author? John.
Yeah. Oh, shoot. Oh, I know his name.
No, is that it?
What?
No, it's such a good book. I really recommend that one.
I know. I'll think of the title and then I'll put it out front. I'll do my staff.
It's just Grendel, right?
Yeah.
And that's the title. Yeah, that one's a fantastic one.
Well, we can't both sit here thinking of it because
then I know. And I think we have a fascination with counter narrative. I was kind of talking about that, and other you know, interpretations of what happened, because the more voices you hear, the closer you get to truth, whatever truth actually is or means. I think we also have an obsession with evil and villains and the formation of evil. And so when you also have a woman who's a villain, you know, it's doubly exciting.
I looked it up. It's John Gardner.
Gardner, yes.
You were close.
It's like, John, something.
Yeah, I remember picking that up and just being amazed, just like with you, just like with Madeline, of, for the first time, going, wait a minute, I've only heard this one-sided thing. There's always two sides. And no, someone's not a hero villain because someone else says he is.
Right. And it's I think retellings are a subversive act. I've talked about this a little bit before, but anytime that you retell a story that's accepted as true or is accepted as canon, you're transferring power away from the storyteller or the traditional storyteller or the system that created this storyteller, right? So it's a transferal of power, and I find it really exciting.
Yeah. And you have, you know, when authors, lots of times, again, like in book club, they'll say, well, that's not the way it happened, or she's not writing it the way it happened. You have total license to write whatever you want. You can tell lies, you can create stories, and that's what you do as an author. And then, as I said, when you let go of the book, which you have, like your first daughter, I guess, it's difficult for you, but it's also fascinating for the reader. And also, at the end of this book, the reader is left thinking about what happens next. What are the possibilities, you know?
And the possibilities. And I love that, you know? I love that the what if should follow you. Those are my favorite books, when I almost have like a book hangover afterwards. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I need a minute before I can pick up another book, pick up another drink. I need to digest and think about it and suffer through it maybe a little bit. Cathartic suffering, though. Good suffering.
Yeah, I don't like books that are wrapped up and then I'm done and it's, you know, I'm put in a box, the book's put in a box. No, it doesn't really help me.
Right. But
speaking of, when you said have another drink, I really enjoyed the night when Stena goes out and gets wasted.
Yeah, totally. She's like, I'm so sick of being the big sister. Like, I'm over it. Yeah. We've all had those moments, I think. Yeah, I have.
A lot of retching in the book.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, she does. She gets a little sick. And yeah, Perseus gets sick. You're right. You know what? It's because I have three little kids. There's a lot of bodily functions happening all the time in my life.
No, you drew inspiration from it. You can tell them that later because you threw up all the time.
Totally.
You helped me create the book.
Thanks.
I was going to say, well, in conclusion, as we wind down, I thought of a question earlier because I'm not sure the answer. I have the answer for myself. Who is your favorite god or goddess?
That is such a hard question. I already told you my childhood one was Athena, for sure. And it's hard to find one that's not so problematic. Is the problem, because the more you learn and the more you read these stories, you realize that these are like pretty terrible characters.
Yeah, because you don't want to pick Zeus and you can't pick obviously Kronos, and then we've talked about Poseidon and Athena and their dark sides, but then you have a minor god like Hephaestus and we both like him.
Yeah, he seems like a good guy. The first thought was Demeter. She's a good mom. She loves her daughter. I can relate to that. But I'm sure if I you know, if I'm sure if I Google her, I'll find some stories that are unsavory.
The thing about Hephaestus was he was really screwed over, but like in your story, it's like he's like a gas station guy trying to fix the car and he goes, no, I can't do it. But if you go down the road, like,
oh my gosh, that's the best ever. And it's so true. Yeah. I know a guy down the road.
Yeah, just like a pleasant guy, had a decent sense of humor. You did a really good job. See, that was the other reason I really enjoyed the book is because, you know, sometimes you'd have a paragraph, but you flesh out a character in that paragraph. That's always nice too.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, so I could go on forever because it's just so much fun, but I guess we ought to like end now. And now, as I said, August 8th, and it'll be in the bookstore on the front shelf. And then next year, it's fun. It's amazing you did this so quickly, or seemingly. But yeah, early next year, I guess, we'll be seeing the new book.
Yes, and we'll come back. If you'll have me, I would like to come back and we can chat all things Rome, because now I know this whole new pantheon. And they're just, it's kind of wild how they create this like hybrid pantheon, you know, an assembly of what the Latin people already had there, plus this influence from Greece as they come over. Also looking at Rome before it's Rome, and it's pretty rural and not so fancy, which is not what we come to think of Rome as being. So yeah, it's been really fun.
Yeah, and without, this is definitely not a spoiler, but you know, the brothers had as strange and complex a relationship as three sisters. I mean, Romulus and Remus, and what happened.
It's a Cain and Abel story.
Yeah. Yes. You know? Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's, again, when you study these old stories, you see not just repetition within a canon, but across them, you know, and across cultures. Like, you know, how many stories have a flood? How many peoples have an apple story, you know, or a snake story? It's pretty cool. It makes me feel really connected to humanity and to the past. And yeah, I'm a big fan of the old stories and making them new.
And even in the prologue, when she recites the different triads, the different versions of three, I was realizing as I read it, these are all stories. Every time she talked about a three, they are all stories that could be written.
I'm going to be busy. I got a lot of stories to write. And my own three children.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I have three. Oh.
Okay, let's leave it there. And we'll see each other early in 2024 when your next book comes out, Mother of Rome.
I'm so excited. Thank you for having me. I had too much fun.
Oh, it's great. Thank you so much.